Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and today I am joined by Bruce Hillman, and we're going to try something new. Hey, Bruce, say hello.
Hello.
Adam Francisco. Adam, go for it.
Hi.
And Scott Keith.
Hello. I feel like I'm on the Commentary Magazine podcast. This is how they do it.
Yeah, a lot of people do this, yeah. And I realized why is it, because we don't do this, we just assume our listeners have been listening long enough to know who we all are. And we want new listeners. We want listeners who have never listened to Thinking Fellows before to be able to sort of pay attention to the conversations. And so I thought we might start trying that in the beginning.
It was like the 80s TV shows when they would like turn at the camera and smile, but this is the podcast version
right.
of that sort of intro.
And especially since Thinking Fellows isn't on video, people have no reference unless they really know who we are. So hopefully the hellos help if you are a new listener today. The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network of Shows. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts to see all of our shows there. /podcast will take you to more than just the Thinking Fellows. We have 20 different podcasts on the 1517 Podcast Network. All right, guys, going through this list of topics, I imagined one December afternoon while I was in the shower and wrote, we are going to...
Oh, no, you don't like... Adam's like, no.
While you were riding the bike trainer.
I was riding the bike, then I got in the shower, then I had podcast ideas, then I got out of the shower, and I wrote down the podcast ideas.
There you
see how that works. So, I didn't write them in the shower, like on the fogged glass in the episode ideas. This is one of the last remaining ones on this this list that I imagine. And this is, what are the three estates? Now, the reason this came up... to mind was we had done some episodes that were sort of have been about Christians interacting with the world around them. We've done a little bit of social commentary. We've done some episodes on the state of Christianity in the world. We've done some episodes about Christians responding to the world of various issues in it. Non-belief, I think one of the last ones we recorded 2 times ago. Was also about building Christian values and things like that. And so from the Reformation, when it comes to the interaction of Christians with their neighbors, there's an important distinction called the three estates that's often not discussed, or I think gets discussed much less frequently than another distinction, which is called the two kingdoms distinction, which people are often familiar with, especially when talking about Christians and politics and things like that. But from what I remember and gather, the three estates is actually more prevalent of an idea in Luther than the two kingdoms. He gives it a little more attention and time. There's certainly elements of it that show up in other places. I think one could even argue some of the Small and Large Catechism. There's pieces of this as well. And so I thought we would... do this episode, and then there's a person on the Thinking Fellows who we might say wrote the book on it.
As he reminded us, literally wrote the book on it.
Literally wrote. I wrote a chapter in a book on it.
Oh, there we go. Now he's
20 years ago.
So, Adam Francisco,
and you can get the book on Amazon.com. Just kidding.
Dude, what's the title of the book, Adam?
Martin Luther and Islam.
Martin Luther it's, and Islam.
It's. I think it goes for about $200 today. So.
You can go buy that on Islam.
Amazon.com.
I wonder
maybe
if
buy me a copy because I don't own a copy. I accidentally gave away my last copy.
I'm assuming this is an adapted version of your dissertation, correct?
Yeah. There's a chapter on how Islam threatens the three estates, so I'm trying to deal with it.
Yep. Very nice. So I thought we would let Adam take the lead here up front and explain to people what three estates are, maybe why they're important, and since they were under threat by Islam, maybe they're under threat by something else today. So, Adam, you want to give us a overview here of what the three estates are?
Yeah, I was, as you were talking, thinking about, because I knew you were going to toss this my way, thinking about how I do this. There's a lot of different ways, but you are right to say that three estates is much more prevalent in Luther's writings than two kingdoms. I don't think you can really understand the two kingdoms properly unless you understand how the three estates are integrated into that doctrine, or that some would call it a worldview, I guess. But you know, the two kingdoms, you know, the sacred and the spiritual, or the secular and the religious,
kingdom of the world, realms, kingdom of the gospel.
Yeah, left, right, these sorts of things. People have in the past, and I forget the name of the scholar who wrote the book on this, but traces the history of the interpretation of the two kingdoms doctrine, and argues that two kingdoms doctrine was falsely interpreted by Enlightenment thinkers who wanted a secular realm that was autonomous completely from God and his word, whether it be his natural revelation or his biblical or scriptural revelation.
So just a natural world not impacted at all by the work of the gospel or the church.
Right.
Kind of what people mean when they say separation of church and state, and they don't know what they're talking about.
In the American tradition, it kind of makes sense why people might do that, because, I mean, even James Madison attributes the kind of like the separation of church and state. He doesn't use the phrase like Jefferson did, the wall of separation, but he kind of is suggesting that he attributes that to Luther approvingly. The interesting thing is, though, if you look at Luther and you read him, you don't have to read him all that closely, is that in the left-hand kingdom, the secular arena, Luther believes that there are holy orders, estates, or hierarchies. Those are the three words he typically uses interchangeably, that are built into the fabric of creation. These are institutions that God has ordained, and those three institutions or estates or orders are the church, the family, which sometimes they'll call the domestic estate, and the state itself, or the political estate. And for Luther, these are God-ordained orders or God-ordained realms. They're holy, and they're also, I'd tack on one more thing that I think is essential for understanding them. Luther in the 16th century lives in, you know, what we could still call, what he called Corpus Christianum, Christendom. And he believed for Christendom as a civilization or a culture to hold together, those three estates had to be maintained. You strike at one, they're sort of the tripod that hold up civilization. If you strike at one, it starts to wobble. And in his day and age, he thought that Islam threatened all three, and therefore threatened the undoing of any, you know, Christian civilization in his day and age, or we might just say kind of classic Western civilization today.
I think this is particularly what brought it to mind for me as we were recording some of the other episodes that did this, is especially when we recorded this, the new nuns kind of episode with people withdrawing, when you look at people's anxiety about churches that are shrinking, and then we started speculating about some answers and things like that on the show, I felt like without saying it, Three Estates stuff came up. Your work, Dad, came up a bunch about being dad and the influence of fathers in the home. I mean, when Adam says stuff like Luther says, if you attack one of these estates, you can sort of attack what you might call a Christian worldview very easily. It seems like we can identify places where that's happened. And Bruce, the other thing that came to mind was when I was refreshing on Three Estates stuff is, as Adam said, the word hierarchy kept coming back up, so that within each estate, a set of authority is given to various people, and you sort of vocationally have to, you have the duty to live where you are in the hierarchy, right? And I feel like that is, we've done these postmodern episodes as well, the hierarchy word's bad, right? And the system of order. So I feel like there's a lot here to unpack as far as people's anxieties and understanding. And so maybe I'll toss it to Bruce, because you brought up the Islam thing before recording too. Is postmodernism sort of the new Islam for Christians?
For attacking the three estates.
For attacking the three estates and thus attacking Christian faith?
He's going to say no.
Go ahead, defend it now. Defend it now.
I am with Adam. He knows.
there are similarities, I guess, in the functional way that both might operate, but obviously they're very different systems. Islam would still be for hierarchies at some level. Postmodernism recognizes hierarchies as, at least in its kind of philosophical form, as indispensable. They're not going to go away, but that's why you have deconstruction, is you're always displacing them so that no one hierarchy is able to, you know, maintain control and have ultimate power, or at least that's how justice is brought into the world in postmodern theory. But I actually have a question that presupposes this, if that's okay, and maybe I can answer it or can be open to everybody, because, and this, I think other people have probably answered this before, it's just a question I've always had with the three estates that I think is related to this, which is, I don't understand how the three estates doctrine fits into democracy, because for two reasons. One, there is no real hierarchy in democracy. Like, you could say, we the people, so the people are the government, so they're the hierarchy. But in some ways, in at least in the American system, the government and the people are not really that much of a difference, right? So it's like the people are the hierarchy, but the people are also the government, and we use the two words interchangeably. And if you think of postmodernism is just an ultra-egalitarian project. It's dismantling hierarchies in a way that's disturbing, but it's an ultra-egalitarian project. So I wonder, how does the three estates work in democracy, or is democracy somehow opposed to this system? Because where's the hierarchy operative in the civil kingdom? And
I would say, I mean, just shooting from the hip.
Postmodernism is like the advanced version of democracy, just like Marxism is another trail that could shoot off democracy if you bring it to extremes.
I would say there's a hierarchy in law. at least they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be we live in a constitutional republic, and there is hierarchy there.
Thank you. For there is clarification there.
Something supposed to be above government, that is the law of the land.
So we operate
a constitution
where we're
so
under government,
not like
that governs,
or a person like Luther talks about it a lot.
Well, right, yeah,
but his
we don't want
is different.
Yeah. Completely agree. I'm just saying, like, does the people, in quotes, the people, is that supposed to represent the goodly prince?
Bruce, I would no, not in our. Are you talking specifically in America?
Yeah,
I guess to start, that'd be easier.
I'm sorry, Adam. You're the actual historian. I'm just over here twitching. It seems to me like in America, the idea is that we give consent to an elected set of representatives to govern us, not to rule us. And now that the governing oftentimes these days, because of various three-lettered agencies, sometimes feels like ruling and looks like ruling. But it's supposed to be governing in the ideal form of it. And there are hierarchies within that, but all of these happen supposedly by the consent of the governed through the electoral representative process. And so in a sense, you do still have, you are consenting to be ruled by the ideas, you know, as they're sort of encapsulated in the protection of your rights under the Constitution, and then the group of people that are elected to enforce those supposedly protection of your rights as represented in the Constitution. And so there's two, I think, within sort of like an idea of the three estates, as when Luther refers to the prince, we're more, and this is what makes it hard, we're more deferring to a set of principles that are supposed to be protecting us more than, or as much at least, as quote unquote governing / ruling us. But we do not have in the United States, we do not have the same context of sort of the prince as Luther thought of it. That's much more, you know, a system that is, in a lot of ways, it's a foreign system to us that we can only encounter by studying history and trying to relate to his experience from the time.
Isn't that the theological problem? I guess that's what I'm raising. I agree with everything you said, but doesn't Luther, and maybe Adam, you can correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Luther's whole point that these three estates are almost, my word, primordial ways that God has structured and ordered the world for the world's good? And so you have
they're
kind of, right, but I'm saying in the American system, for example, I'm just trying to ask, like, is the American system falling, does it not fit neatly into Luther's categories, or is it directly opposed to them? Like,
it's, well, it's based more on natural law than it is on scriptural truths. And so that's the first, you know,
doesn't Luther say that, like, these are God ordained?
Yeah, but he was not a, at the end of the day, he was sort of deontological in that, right? So that what he knew is what was from all eternity is informed more by the scriptures and by a philosophical perspective of, you know, Aristotelian natural law. Now he's aware of that, of course. But at the end of the day, it's been a hot minute since I've looked at this, but a lot of this is based on scriptural passages, including things from Romans 13. And that seems like the point of departure that we could encounter in a sense is that, you know, Romans 13 is premised on the idea that really, I mean, Paul's writing this regarding the Roman government, that every government is set into place by God at the end of the day for your protection. And I think the idea there is
the order of society.
Yeah, the order of society. That I think the idea there is at the end of the day, without something, it'd be sort of Lord of the Flies, and nobody would be protected by anything. I mean, I'm a bit of an anarcho-capitalist, so I'd love to have a discussion with Paul about that. But
it goes further than that, though, because he's also saying if you don't listen to the prince, that's part of the problem of disrupting the order. It's not just like these are categories that exist and are good. It's that, but it's also that
I think Paul does something similar in Romans 13. Like, I think if you take Romans 13 and its warnings very similarly, you could say, even if there's a bad, unchristian prince who makes laws against Christians, if you do not follow them, even though they conflict with your faith,
you will meet the sword. Yeah.
And I think for the three estates,
it's pragmatic.
I think for the three estates as well, if you do not listen to the prince, and, you know, in America, I think more and more people are waking up to this, by the way, but we can detach ourselves from a prince and say it's principles, but we elect officials who are in a hierarchy above us. You often, once they're there, even if they're doing things that are illegal, things like that, they govern with a particular set of powers that you don't have. There's a hierarchy there. You can shake
your head, but you elect
to answer
the governor. And
to answer Bruce's question a little while ago, Luther's doctrine, for fancy people, Dreistandelehre, the three estates doctrine.
Ooh, that was fancy. I like it.
Yeah, very fancy, but I like the way I said it.
I do too. just getting better.
So Luther's doctrine is, Luther believed this thing, this was universal. At one place he said something like the three estates shall continue until the end of time, and these three estates you can find across the entire globe. And in a way, it's kind of that's Luther thinking abstractly, and not, he doesn't really know much about
the world
outside of Europe. So, yeah. But it's interesting how our conversation jumped immediately to, or not immediately, pretty quickly to the political estate. For Luther, though, there's hierarchy to those orders, and he's a little fidgety here. So
that's why I brought it up, because within each estate, I think he has three. Doesn't he have three hierarchies within each one as well?
Well, it gets really messy. But for him, it seems like the totality of his comments on the three estates, which are everywhere, and I think it was Oswald Bayer argues quite compellingly that while it's easy to reduce Luther's hermeneutic to or when he's reading scripture to law gospel, obviously it's much more complicated than that. And he argues that actually the three estates is sort of primary as well. But when Luther's talking about the three estates as they relate to each other, he's always going to put either the family or the church first in order of priority. Yeah. And everything, the next serve that. And I would argue Luther's going to emphasize, and you see this in his Genesis commentary when he's reflecting on creation, that the first estate God created or institution God put into the world is the marital union between Adam and Eve. But alongside of it, also the religious estate. He imagines that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is the first altar. And, you know, it's Luther being a little creative with the, you know, what you find in Genesis 1 through 3. But the family is the, for all intents and purposes, the first thing. And so therefore, political order, whatever shape it might take, is meant to protect, preserve, and serve the family. And on that note, I would say democracy as we currently have it actually does work against the estate of the family. It rips, I mean, we could go, Scott, you and I could probably go quite extreme on this. Like you think of like you send your kids off to public school and I've sent my kids off to public school, right? So this is not me just knocking it, you know, all around, but what's the whole point of public education? It's basically childcare.
Yeah, especially compulsory versions of it.
And so like what you end up is like other people, agents of the state are raising a couple's children for them in those, you know, from what, 8 to 4, whatever time it is, you know. And so you get, not in all cases, certainly, and there are wonderful, wonderful public school teachers out there. Public education does for families who just need something like that. The public school system can be very helpful. I think of like our little boy we had, Tremaine. He, when we dropped him off at his IEP school at, or whatever it's called, I've never seen people care for a boy they did not know more than that moment. It kind of changed my mind a bit about my heavy critiques of public education. They just have more resources, right? So they can do that sort of thing. They can give 4 people therapists and stuff to one person, right? But that is the democracy as we have it. I mean, allow me to have a radical moment here. It works against the three estates, absolutely. I would say applied. Sorry, Scott. One more thing.
No, go.
Postmodernism as a sort of like academic exercise, whatever. Applied postmodernism, as I think it's James Lindsay is the one who coined the term, and Helen Pluckrose, that were all of a sudden the principles of postmodernism, the deconstructionism, the relativism, if you will, applied to a social political context, is an undoing of the three estates. The key takeaway for Luther's doctrine of the three estates as it's applied today is just that Luther believes that there's a particular order to things, that families are comprised according to God's design of a husband and a wife and children. Now, sometimes things happen and that gets messed up, but that's the blueprint, right, for the family. And there's concentric circles around that. So that's the thing that's, goes back to your question. I think this doctrine does not apply. It's really hard to apply it to our contemporary context, but where it is helpful is in the recognition that there is order. There's an order to things. There's a design to
order, right? A telos order. Yeah,
absolutely. A telos in the sense that we're driving towards something, but also a telos in the sense that there's things are here for a particular purpose. Marriage is here for a particular purpose to bring a man and a woman together in this union to work together. And with the understanding, if you will, that children will often result from that. Sometimes nature doesn't allow for that to happen, but that's the sort of like the design. We live in a sinful world, though, so sometimes things don't fall into their design. Sorry, Scott, I interrupted you.
No, what you said was better. I was just going to point out that it's interesting in the example that you pointed out of the little boy that you and Rachel cared for a time. The state, in that sense, provided resources that his actual parents couldn't provide. For sort of a deep, or couldn't or wouldn't, for a deeper need that this child had. And to me, that's a little bit different of a situation. I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but it's just a little bit different of a situation than sort of the state mandating that you and Rachel send your kids' kids.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is
absolutely
sort of outside the realm of what I think Luther would have ever envisioned a political state would ever do, in a sense. Although they did a lot of that themselves.
So I was just thinking of, you know, the public school, the equivalent to a public school system that emerges in the
is set up by Melanchthon, Reformation and Luther.
Yeah.
So I think,
but they're still living in the context of Christendom in a sense, you know.
But so in what we have here is sort of more of a Dewey guided actual state operation than one that was set up by the church to educate children, first of all, to read so that they could read the Bible, and then to then interact within the other estate, the family, and then to interact within the other estate and the civil estate and be able to read and write and do basic numbers so that they could have a vocation that provided for the family. You know, that's not, I mean, ideally, maybe that's what our schools originally did, but it's just, so different now.
I think whether, like, to a degree of which the ideals exist in each of these, too, right? Because, like, even the polity, we didn't get to it, but the polity of our churches is substantially different than the polity of churches during the Reformation, down to the fact that they even include democratic elements, right, electing people into various offices and things like that. There's not the same sort of order of bishops in our particular church. I'm pretty sure not in yours too, right, Bruce? Stuff like that. And so you just have differences from the way Luther experienced it, but I don't think that actually escapes us from some of the rules, warnings, or insights that this brings, or some of the problems of trying to escape or demolish any of these estates. So if you try to demolish a hierarchy or an organization or an institution called a church to which you are subject under and a member of or things like that, there will be problems. If you try to demolish, usurp, get around the family, there are going to be substantial problems. And if you try to demolish, get rid of, no longer be under the authority of a government, there are going to be consequences and issues that happen that affect each of our lives. And so I think vocationally, too, each of your sort of vocations, sets of vocations, will happen within these, what you might call institutions, right? And so I think it actually helps you identify how to act in particular places as well, in the sense that, like Adam said, there's even an order to these, that like my vocation as a parent is more substantial in this hierarchy, but that within a place there, like I have a greater obligation as somebody who's high on the hierarchy of family right now with kids who are dependent on me to then act in the civil realm accordingly to that vocation, right? So that even when it comes to democracy, or things I can vote on, polls I can go take place on, or local issues that I can have effect on, the driving force there would of my decision making would be my family and then my church, and then maybe my country or something like this. And I think those types of order are kind of scary and offensive to people's sensibilities, that like the way I behave as an American citizen would be informed first by some other things. Particularly my Christianity and my marriage relationship with a family.
That's silly that it would be, though, because everybody's civil interactions are informed by other things, up to and including the way that they were raised, right? Whether that be Christian or otherwise, you're going to interact with other people, civilly, politically, whatever, according to sort of the presuppositions that you enter into those interactions, assuming. And it's expected, I would think, that Christians do that with when they interact in the world with their Christianity. And I think the fact that it's sort of maybe, and I'm taking this from your word, that is looked for the most part, looked down upon publicly now is just odd to me, because it's not, if anything you could say about the world in which we live currently is that it's in a way more moral, quote unquote, than it's ever been. And I don't mean that to say that I agree with the moral system under which these people operate. But they certainly, there certainly are a lot of moral guidelines that we're all supposed to keep pretty solidly, including, you know, not being a racist, not being sexist, not valuing inclusivity and diversity and
environmental protection
above all other things. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. Like, I've never been so moralized in my life as I am now. Now, those morals don't match what I hold to be good and true, as I know that from the scriptures, at least not always or not most of the time. But I'm certainly beat over the head with a series of moral propositions now more than I've ever been, which is an odd thing to me, having this was supposedly in a postmodern relativistic world that nothing seems all that relative. It all seems pretty certain. And that's kind of bugs me at the end of the day, because the basis of the certainty seems weaker than the basis of the certainty we had previous to it.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I think this brings up for me is we've talked about before, but people have a particular type of anxiety about what is happening in the world. Maybe it is really, really bad. Maybe people imagine that it's worse than it is. But everybody I talk to who's Christian at my local church, you can see this online, it's the destruction of the Christian values or moral value framework that you were raised with or experienced in the world as sort of the predominant, maybe universal, not everybody was living by it, but that was kind of the rules that were laid out. The destruction of that has everybody very anxious and amped up. And the reactions are, dramatic on a lot of sides.
We went to Disneyland yesterday. I'm more anxious today than I was the day before yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish you would have gotten pictures of you and Cinderella.
The thing that did
played by a man
that I really thought would get posted online is my solid 40-minute nap on the ground in Toontown.
He did. He just sat on the ground and fell asleep in Toontown.
That's awesome.
Do the three estates give us a directive or an opportunity to put that anxious energy into something? Does it help us organize that instead of just throwing the anxious energy out into the ether as posts online or yelling or going to political rallies or whatever it may be? Like, is there something about the three estates that can be helpful to people who are anxious about what the heck should I do? The world is falling apart. I have no idea what to do. Help me now.
I think, Adam, you said it was Beyer who said that law gospel is certainly certainly prevalent in Luther, but so are the three estates as an interpretive mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
When I read Luther, I don't think that's untrue, but I see vocation as just so wrapped up in this. The idea of the doctrine of vocation is just so wrapped up in this. And that you're never going to understand two kingdoms or three estates, or even maybe sort of our particular way of connecting the gospel to proclamation without a solid idea.
Actually put three estates under the heading of vocation.
I'm sure, yeah.
You're tracking right on with that, yeah.
Yeah, a vocation, because Caleb asked, what energy can you put this into? And Adam used the sort of concentric circles, which is hard to, I think, picture without a whiteboard so you can draw them. But basically, it's the idea that vocationally God has placed people in your life and you serve them. It's not even that you desire to serve them, you just do serve them because vocationally that's how God intended it. And this works out with concentric circles. Now, when we talked about three estates, Adam said there's a hierarchy. And that tightest circle that you have will be your family. When you're a child, that's going to be your parents, your grandparents, your siblings. When you're an adult, that's going to be your wife, your children, your parents, maybe your grandparents if they're still alive, aunts and uncles if they're still alive. And that then works itself out to sort of the next time one, which might be coworkers or actual neighbors, and out and out and out. The further you get out, you've now sort of made it into the second hierarchy or another hierarchy of civil society, right? And how you interact there. But this is, so yeah, what can you put your energy into rather than posting and freaking out? I think the funniest thing, not the funniest, the most ironic thing about the world that we live in now is that I live in California and I'm often freaking out about stuff that happens in Montana. You know, as if I have any at all ability to influence anything that happens in, I don't know, Pennsylvania, Montana, New York City, or whatever like that. I barely have enough influence in my own little 13,000 person community to affect something, let alone something that's thousands of miles away and separated from me by millions of people before I get there.
And that's the place where we try first, I think, is interesting. And what Adam said at the beginning of the show was, when we started talking about the estates, what did we immediately all of us start talking about? The political estate.
Right.
And we started talking about actually like the biggest level of the
political estate. I blame Bruce, he asked. Yeah.
But even then, we talk about the biggest level of the political estate, which is sort of our
federal.
Our federal democratic processes.
But think about the barriers. Like if something that I didn't like was going on where Adam lives in Chicago and it was really upsetting me and I really wanted to do something about it, I would literally have to travel thousands of miles and go through millions of people to get there before I could get myself in a situation where I was close enough to actually maybe exert influence on what was going on there. Yeah. That's bizarre.
Or you could be super rich and not have to worry about all that.
Well, and I could write a big check.
Jeff Bezos could probably go to Chicago and have influence.
Well, this is true, but we're talking about, what, five people on the planet.
Oh, this is to my point, though. I'm agreeing.
Well, or when, for instance, to bring, not to like hound people with schools, but often when we talk about how do we get our kids to do, believe, or read X, Y, and Z, we then talk about how to influence our schools.
Or how do we help the numbers in the church? We talk about all those other people out there, and you rarely hear people talking about how they're going to keep their kids in the church into adulthood so that then their kids and grandkids are in the church into adulthood. We talk about seeker sensitivity and changing the music so that outside, which is all, I don't care. Have those conversations. That's great. Heck, man, I'm lead 15, 17. We're all about bringing people into the church. But maybe in this, we think about the first things first, the things we can actually have some impact on.
How do I influence my kids? They're sitting two doors down and you go, I'm going to the school board meeting. It's like, okay, well, they're two bedroom doors down. And so I think that's, part of that hierarchy too, is like the most influence I have is my family. Then the second most I probably have is my church. And then
in our church, you're kind of a dictator.
Well, I think you're thinking about just what you've said. This is important. Like it's easy to take the three estates doctrine or the sense of order very rigidly. I think that kind of was behind Bruce's question. Like you can't. I mean, it's always, I think, dangerous to take a theologian. Not dangerous in like some emotional way, right? But to take a historical theologian. Maybe who live, 500 years ago, almost 500 years ago, abstract his doctrines from his particular context and move on forward into a radically different social and political arena. And now I think like what you were just saying, I think it is essential, not just for understanding Luther, but just for understanding the Christian life, that vocation be up front and center. And things like two kingdoms, three estates, and so on are kind of informing, but the central role is vocation. Who are you called to? What are your stations right now? What stations maybe do you aspire to? But more important are, what are your stations now? And who are the people around you that you can influence in a positive, a biblical way?
And well, up to the vocation of pastor and preacher within the church. This is how if you're going to go back to kingdoms, the kingdom of the gospel operates in the state of the church. This is how that estate operates, because we call preachers and pastors to come preach the word faithfully and to administer the sacraments rightly, according to God's word, to a particular group of people who are then also in their own way called to be members of that congregation and to support that congregation. We just did a Romans 12 church a couple weeks ago to support that congregation, each according to their own gifts. And that's going to include a swap over to other vocations as mother and father, grandparents, aunts and uncles,
yes,
friends, all that.
And if there is a relativism, Bruce, I'm going to tip my hat to you.
Tipping of a hat.
Vocation is relative to it for each and every individual in many ways, like to their particular station. So I would want to resist like a wooden imposition of like some sort of concept of three estates of vocation from the 16th century on us today. It's just, there are dogmas, things that are fixed and unchanging. Then there are doctrines from Luther that, especially when it comes to his teachings on social and ethical life, that just don't really fit squarely with our context. But vocation is a biblical teaching, to be sure, and is, and there are certain things within certain things that are universal to us all, and vocation should inform or would inform that our activity in those arenas. The shortcut in all this is you could just contact some certain pastors in like a place like Wyoming and just ask them, what should you do with your life? And they'll tell you exactly what to do. Sorry. You may want to cut that out, but if you got some cojones, you won't.
Adam was on a speaking gig tour this weekend and had some encounters.
I feel like this begs a question, though, which I still kind of don't fully understand, which is, so I'm in complete agreement with everything you guys have said about the doctrine of vocation, but what confuses me is, I'll put it this way, you don't need a doctrine of three estates to have a doctrine that wherever you find yourself, you should live for the good of your neighbor. You don't need the doctrine to affirm that. So it goes back to me like, well, then have we really answered the question, what's the point?
Well, because you don't need, in a lot of ways, you don't need any, I'm going to do air quotes for people that cannot see because we're not recording this, air quotes. You do not need, quote, many of these things, this is
the project of systematic theology, right?
Yeah, it's just
give these things labels.
It's helpful in understanding and teaching in the scripture that might not itself come out didactically and say, this is this and that is that and this is this, to have a learned individual like Luther study the scriptures and say, this is a helpful way to understand this. So that now, can you get the meaning, or the oomph of this without Luther's specific breakdown of the three estates? Sure you can, but
can I say this?
It's a helpful way to understand these teachings in scriptures.
I think it's a
biblical theologian asking systematicians, what good is systematics theology?
Well,
that's what just happened.
I also think this is like the application of the law in a right way to these particular vocations, which is, you can just say, love your neighbor in every context, but something like the three estates helps you understand who you are as a neighbor in those contexts, and is the wielding of a word that comes from scripture sort of against the simple inclination of you not to be a good neighbor, right? Like vocation and these particular estates, they're, I think one of the things with it is it tells you have a place, and that is always structuring you. It's always a word of law, and it's a word of law that is necessary for and good for human life here. And
it's a state of affairs, right? Like you would argue, it's a state of affairs. It's not you. No one cannot in the realm of the theory that it's espousing. No one cannot have it be true.
Yeah,
you can't violate it. because it's the state of affairs.
Or escape it, I guess, would be the... Yeah, yeah. You can't get outside of it. And so to know it and to be able to identify it, I think is just helpful for understanding, for teaching, for knowing your limits, for calling people out when they violated those state of affairs, for having a word that's not just, you've upset me, but I think you're disrupting. I think those things are... I don't know. I think that's just the general way of doing systematic or professional or any, you know, ordered theology. And then to order particular realms of vocation, I think is helpful, especially I believe it's helpful when people are asking for help. Like when I go to my church, people are, and not just my church, but you go to churches, people are asking for help, organizing their churches, fighting against sort of this slow death of attendance. People are asking for help in the political realm. People are asking for help understanding their duty and their role or what to do as a parent. I feel lost. And so if I can sort of have a mechanism by which my approach to those things is ordered, and then teach that order and hand that order off to people, I think that just can be helpful, if not like a biblical mandate to be necessary to teach. It just is helpful for people to understand and to be able to check their vocations against.
On order, from a very different type of author and context, Russell Kirk, you know, one of these sort of National Review-ish sort of traditional, I think you might call him a paleo-conservative kind of thinkers. His first line in his book, The Roots of American Order, is man's first need is order. And he's not just talking about, as he traces it in the book, the political order that the United States took or how that all worked, you know, from ancient days up until the founding of America and so on, but rather that human beings in living in community would, you know, amongst each other, people from different backgrounds and so on and so forth, need some type of order or recognition that there is a right way things should be constituted in terms of family and its relationship to religion or politics and so on. And I think that the key takeaway for the doctrine of the three estates or the three orders is simply just that there is order. It will take different forms in different places. But in many ways, I mean, it's not up to us to kind of discover it, because it's been discovered already, but to maybe fine tune what the order that has been discovered in nature. And so behind all of the three estates is also a pretty healthy doctrine of natural law, natural knowledge of God, natural revelation, which Lutherans aren't all that typically that keen on. I don't know about Bruce.
Yeah.
There's my Thomism. I'd say
these days, I'm not sure I agree that we're not keen on it, but we should probably end it before I go too far on that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. But yeah, that's a whole different, maybe that's a different conversation for another podcast.
Remember having those theoretical conversations 11 years ago in your office before it was very popular? I do.
Yeah. 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 I've always been a man ahead of my time.
You have. It's pretty
trendsetter.
Pretty remarkable, actually.
All right, guys. Well, great. Thank you for joining me on this episode. If you enjoyed or found this conversation helpful, you can subscribe to the show in your favorite podcasting apps. You can also support us by hitting the support this show link down below. You can sign up for a monthly recurring donation of any amount. That is the way to help keep the Thinking Fellows and the 1517 Podcast Network moving forward, to continue producing episodes, adding shows to the podcast network, adding things like video podcasts to 30 minutes, etc. Those resources and take people and time and talent, and the way we're able to gather those things together is through the generous support of listeners like you. Go to 1517.org/donate, or you can just follow that link in the show notes below. We appreciate your time, and we will catch you next time. Bye.
Hey friends, it's Eric Sorensen, co-host of 30 Minutes in the New Testament, here with a special announcement. And that announcement is that 30 Minutes in the New Testament can now be found on YouTube. If you click on the link in the show notes here just below me, you're going to see that we have our own YouTube page. And the reason we're doing that is because from now on, we're going to be recording not just audio of the episodes, which will continue on the various podcast platforms that you use, but we're also going to film our episodes so that you can access video. And so make sure to click on that link, subscribe today so you can keep up with all the clips we release and all our future episodes. Thanks so much.